1460 WVOA.
Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. The program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can also be heard live streaming on WVOX.com. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110. But as I sage week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest today is historian Richard Brightman, and our subject is the book he co-authored, Refugees and Rescue, The Diary and Papers of James McDonald, 1933 to 1945, and the role of American regarding immigration in that critical period before the Second World War and during. Welcome, Professor Brightman, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm pleased to be here.
No, it's always a pleasure. Richard Brightman is the author or co-author of 9 books and many articles in German, U.S. history, and the Holocaust. His book, The Architect of Genocide, Himmler and the Final Solution, won the Frankel Prize for Contemporary History and was translated into 5 languages. He's written books, The Official Secrets, What the Nazis Planned, What the British and the Americans Knew. He has also appeared in 5 foreign languages. His recent books are editions of the diaries of James G. McDonald, who was the League of Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and chairman of President Franklin Roosevelt's Advisory Committee on Political Refugees from 1933 to 1945. He received his BA at Yale University in 1969, graduating summa cum laude, the highest distinction in history of political science. He received his MA and PhD in history from Harvard University. That's very good pedigree, we all know. Brightman teaches at American University, is editor of the journal Holocaust and Genocide Studies. He served as director of historical research for the Nazi War Criminal Records and Imperial Japanese Records Interagency Working Group, which helped to bring about the declassification of more than 8 million pages of U.S. government records under a 1998 law. And, of course, very little has been explored about Japanese war crimes, and that'll leave for another show, but it's very interesting how that's sort of been lost to history. Meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. On this show, much of the program is devoted to public policy. 2 years into World War II, Americans were so opposed to intervening on behalf of Britain that in the last Gallup poll taken before the attack on Pearl Harbor, 90% of the public said that the Americans should not physically help Britain, even if it meant their invasion and collapse. That's sort of remarkable. Between 1933 and 1937, only 40,000 Jews came to the United States legally through immigration quotas and visas and acceptance. Of course, many had left Germany for other countries, never expecting their lives to be threatened outside of Hitler's grasp. They never anticipated a world war. They surely never expected to be victims of the Final Solution. And after Kristallnacht in 1938, almost all Jews filled the American national origin quota, approximately 25,000 a year from Germany, and more than 110,000 Jews legally immigrated to the United States. In fact, during those years, over half of the immigrants to the United States were Jewish. There was also some illegal immigration, and the administration, at least the executive branch, did not make an effort to prevent it from happening. Professor Brightman, you and your co-authors have put together the diary and the papers of James McDonald, which reveals some of the background regarding immigration policy inside and outside the Houses of Congress, the White House, and the State Department. With that in mind, who was this man, James McDonald, Professor?
Well, he was a product of the Midwest. He grew up in a small town in Indiana. He went to Indiana University and then to graduate school at Harvard. He became head of something called the Foreign Policy Association. And in that connection, during the 1920s, he met both Roosevelt's Franklin and Eleanor. Eleanor was on his board of supervisors. In 1932, he knew that the German situation was pretty bad, and he went there in the spring of 1933 to get a look at Nazi Germany, and what he saw alarmed him, and he came back trying to do something about it. He eventually became commissioner, high commissioner for the League of Nations on Refugees.
You know, it's interesting, with all the controversy regarding immigration, there have been countless books, there's been countless accusations, countless hand-wringing over it, America's role, Western Europe's role, etc. Of course, the 30s were different, and we most people who know history understand that. McDonald is a virtual unknown to most people interested in what was happening regarding immigration. He kept a diary along with a great deal of his personal papers, and obviously much of that was saved. When and why did he keep a diary, and why was it not available for years before to historians? It's been 65 years or so.
I think he met so many people and went to so many meetings that he kept a diary partly to keep track of everything that he was doing. He had pretty good secretarial support as head of the Foreign Policy Association and later as League of Nations High Commissioner. And he liked to record everything that he had heard and discussed in the course of business during the day. It wasn't really so much a personal diary as it was a detailed business diary.
Did he keep it in, obviously he wrote it in hand, did he later write it on typewriters? Did he keep written that kind of printed notes so it was easier to read?
Actually, he dictated most of it to secretaries or his regular stenographer who typed it out. And so most of it is typewritten, although he did make additions and corrections in hand.
Well, that made it a lot easier.
Yes.
You know. It's interesting. Over the past 65 years, since the end of the Second World War, more and more information has been revealed regarding the effort to save first German and then European Jews from the fate that Hitler had designed for them. McDonald, as you stated, was a key witness to much of what was going on. The basis of his book is a diary which you call synthetic. Why is much of Refugees and Rescue a synthetic diary, and what is a synthetic diary?
Good questions. There are supposed to be three volumes of this series of McDonald diaries. The first volume, we have a term in common, it's called Advocate for the Doomed. The first volume covered the period from late 1932 up until into 1935. And during that time period, he kept a diary systematically. Mm. Unfortunately, after he decided to resign as League of Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, he either stopped keeping a diary or what little he kept was lost. Mm. And so there is a gap between the middle of 1936 and 1946. And in 1946, he got involved in events regarding Palestine. He was ultimately named the first American ambassador to the new state of Israel. And he kept a diary for that time period. That volume of his diaries has not yet appeared. So we, the editors, faced a problem. We had a first volume sustained by a very large diary, a projected third volume with a very large diary. But in the middle, we had only small amounts of diary. So we decided that we would construct a diary from his correspondence, from other people's diaries or correspondence, from some government records, and we would fill in a little bit of our own narrative in order to connect things smoothly. But you can tell what is ours because it's in italics,
right,
and what is in regular type and therefore what historians call primary sources, sources from the time.
Right. You know, I'm looking at the book right in front of me, and I read it. It's very fascinating. And one of your co-authors is Barbara McDonald Stewart. I assume that's his daughter. Is that, am I correct on that?
That is his younger daughter.
Right. And I gather she was able to give you quite a bit of personal information that you couldn't have acquired any other place.
She gave us a great deal of both substantive information and color, the feel of things,
sure,
so far as she knew about it.
Yeah. You know, President Franklin D. Roosevelt was acutely aware of the threat Hitler posed to the German people, Europe, and the world from the time they both ascended to office in 1933. Even while battling the Depression, he was interested in foreign policy. He addressed the question of dictatorship in Europe with his quarantine speech in 1937, which I may editorially mention was quite rejected by the American press. They were very fearful and very isolationist, both the public and the press. What was McDonald's relationship to FDR, and how did he become the chairman of his advisory committee on refugees, even though he had met them? And what was his relationship?
Well, I think he was closer to Eleanor than he was to Franklin, because she had served on his board and the mm-hmm. Foreign Policy Association. McDonald wanted to become American ambassador to Germany and hoped that Roosevelt would name him.
Mm.
And so...
Dodd was the ambassador, am I right?
Dodd got named, yes, right. in place of McDonald.
Yeah.
McDonald went off to Germany and kind of buffered his expertise and came back and got a meeting with Roosevelt in May of 1933 and told him all about what was going on in Germany. Mm. And so they kept in touch because Roosevelt, I think he liked McDonald. He knew he was an expert, and he had seen things firsthand. When McDonald resigned as League of Nations High Commissioner, he took a job with the New York Times and then went on to something else in Brooklyn. And when Roosevelt got interested in an international effort to refugee problems and Jewish problems in 1938, he invited McDonald along with a bunch of other experts to form an advisory committee, and McDonald became its chairman.
Mm. You know, of course, as you mentioned, Eleanor Roosevelt was deeply involved in the refugee problem, and she operated outside the constraints of government. She always wanted to do that. In fact, there was talk when Hillary Clinton was elected to the Senate that it was remembered by a few that Eleanor Roosevelt had been offered that, and she felt that was a constraint on her, and she wanted to be more or less independent, even as First Lady. She was able to do things and meet with people who her husband, the president, was sort of limited politically, was cautious about that. How did McDonald emote with Eleanor Roosevelt, and what were some of her efforts that were outside of the normal channels?
Well, Eleanor basically gave McDonald more access than he would have had on his own. When he needed something or he wanted something and he knew it was going to be difficult, he tended to go to Eleanor, and she would either talk to her husband or write something for her husband or say, in effect, can't you do something about this? This is wrong. This is an injustice. As you indicated, she liked to be independent. She liked to speak up for moral principle, and she didn't have to run for election or worry about Senate confirmation.
Mm. You know, also, just as a backgrounder for our audience to understand, there were, from the 1920s, very strict immigration laws in the United States, called basically under the catch-all of national origin, reflective of what the basis of the American population was at the time of basically the 1920s. And one of the quotas, every country had a quota, and Germany had a quota of approximately 25,000 people. And very few Germans really wanted to run out of Germany by the time President Roosevelt was in office. Hitler, in his charismatic manner, had brought back interest in German nationalism and German pride. But as well documented as everybody above the age of 12 knows, that the Jewish people were the scapegoat in Germany and wanted to immigrate anywhere outside of Germany. And in fact, the German Jewish population was only 1% of Germany, about 500,000 people. And many of those German Jews were either being forced out of Germany or running out as quickly as possible to all parts of Europe. Now, could you frame quickly, why couldn't they be accepted in other countries? What was the limitations, aside from the United States quotas, which were rarely filled?
Well, you have to take into account, first of all, the general level of anti-Semitism, and secondly, the Depression. The Depression basically cut down willingness to accept any kind of immigration in most places. And that was true in the United States as well. You quite accurately traced the 1920s decisions to restrict immigration. But it's also important to mention the decision by President Hoover in 1930 to act through a press release, really, not even an executive order, to cut down immigration through tightening immigration regulations. Mm. And this had nothing to do with anti-Semitism, and it had nothing to do with the situation in Germany, because Hitler wasn't yet in power. It was a reaction to the Depression, and it was kind of typical of what countries did when they had high levels of unemployment and not much prospect of additional jobs.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Eastern Europe, where many Jews had immigrated from in the period from 1900 basically to the First World War and into Germany, because Germany was a prosperous country, Germany was an enlightened country, Germany was a country that socially was advanced. Many of these people were really not regarded as full German citizens, and of course, when the Nazi Party took control, these people were being forced back to their countries of national origin and being rejected quite often.
That's correct. There were tugs of war over where people belonged.
So there was, and we're going to get into this a little bit later about the details of our State Department, but there was obviously a tremendous amount of flux going on regarding people, their nationality, borders. At this period of time, you had a tremendous effort by German nationalism to absorb Germans, both in East Prussia, the Anschluss in Austria, the Sudeten Germans in northern Czechoslovakia. All this was something new almost for what we would think the enlightened part of the 20th century. How did this affect policy in the more enlightened Western European countries like England and France?
Most countries felt that Germany was causing problems for them and that Nazi Germany should stop doing it. They didn't want to have to deal with the flow of refugees, most of whom were Jewish, but there were non-Jews as well. This was Germany causing trouble. This was Germany being a bad partner in the international system. And the notion that they should take advantage of the quality of emigrants from Germany and also act in humanitarian ways before it was too late was very slow to set in.
Mm. You know, Rabbi Steven Weiss was America's most famous Jew of that era. He happened to marry my parents, remarkably, in 1935. And he was very close to FDR. If anyone was very close to FDR, you know, that's a bone of contention anyhow. Revisionists, modern-day revisionists like Raphael Medoff and David Wyman have criticized him for being too soft on the president. Does James McDonald have any views on the work of Rabbi Weiss and what his influence was regarding this tremendous human crisis that was developing in Germany at the moment?
Well, Weiss and McDonald worked together on the president's advisory committee, so they certainly had a lot of contact and agreed on many issues. I wouldn't say that they agreed on all issues. Wise's view was that he was, of course, a great liberal as well as being a Jewish leader, and therefore he had a very positive impression of FDR and the New Deal. I think from the Jewish perspective, he understood that it was going to be difficult for Roosevelt to do certain things because of Congress and public opinion. But it was better to, if you wanted government to act positively, it was better to have good relations than to be confrontational. And I think that, you know, some of the time Wise was quite correct, and perhaps some of the time he was a little too inclined to accept FDR's difficulties and not press hard enough. MacDonald was a little less tolerant than Wise was, but I would say they're pretty close on the spectrum.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting, and we're coming up against a break, but I just want to remind people that the Holocaust didn't exist in Germany up until the beginning of the Second World War. There were very few. There were a number of Jews in concentration camps. I believe half the Jews had immigrated from Germany to either the United States or other places in Europe and South America. And no one in there had ever believed that the Holocaust, in the sense that developed out of the Wannsee Convention in 1941, that is, that's years later, would ever result in the liquidation of German Jews, no less European Jews. You know, we're coming up against a commercial break, and I want to remind our audience that they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX, 1460 AM, live streaming on WVOX.com with myself, Richard Garfunkel. My guest is historian and professor Richard Brightman, and we're talking about the refugee crisis of the 1930s. When we come back from the break, I'm going to ask Professor Brightman the following question. Why did FDR change his views about refugee and refugee policy over time? And why was there so much congressional opposition to European immigration? We'll be back in a moment or two. Thank you.
Of making you talk.
Well, okay, hotshot.
WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lori London. Some say yesterday's primaries paint a picture of what's to come.
You've heard me talk all year about the rebellion that's going on in America.
House Republican leader John Boehner on Tea Party wins in Delaware's GOP Senate, New York's GOP gubernatorial primary over establishment candidates. But Democrats think it could work in their favor.
I think is a pretty good example, both in a congressional race and in a Senate race in Delaware, that that makes winning those races for the Republicans a fundamentally harder task.
White House spokesman Robert Gibbs predicting Democrats will maintain their majority in the House and Senate. Well, nearly 5 months after the nation's worst environmental disaster.
We started this morning the final drilling process to close in on the bottom of the Macondo well.
Incident commander Thad Allen says the blown out Gulf Oil well will be permanently sealed and declared dead by Sunday. Fox News. We report. You decide.
Securing America. On reports, the feds are considering filing charges against cleric Anwar al-Awlaki. The American Civil Liberties Union says it won't stop their lawsuit, which challenges the government's right to brand the U.S. citizen as a terrorist and authorize his killing. The ACLU says bringing charges based on credible evidence would be a step in the right direction. Sources tell Fox it's believed al-Awlaki provided training for accused Christmas Day underwear bomber Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who's charged and in custody in Detroit. If Abdulmutallab strikes a plea deal, he could be the prime witness against al-Awlaki if he were charged, captured alive in Yemen, and extradited. Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Tired of paying outrageous prices for monthly prescriptions? Then stop. Stop overpaying for your medications. For over a decade, CanadaDrugs.com has helped Americans just like you save up to 80% off their prescriptions. No premiums, no hidden fees, no enrollment programs, no hassles. Just you saving money. Call CanadaDrugs.com now for a free quote. 800-851-5484. Safe, affordable, brand and generic medications you know and trust at big discounts. And a 100% money-back guarantee. Call CanadaDrugs.com and get free quotes, free shipping, no contracts, and savings up to 80%. We'll answer all your questions and explain exactly how much you'll save. So call 800-851-5484. That's 800-851-5484. Or visit CanadaDrugs.com. You'll be glad you did.
Can I give you this bracelet? You know, just in case something happens to me.
So what if my grades have been dropping and I've ditched all my friends?
Guess what? I'm going away. Really, I am this time.
Every year, one out of every 14 high school students share many of these same thoughts right before they attempt suicide. To learn more about suicide prevention, visit omh.state.ny.us, then click Suicide Prevention. Sponsored by the New York State Office of Mental Health and the New York State Broadcasters Association.
This is Rabbi Emeritus Amiel Wohl. Our Temple Israel of New Rochelle is celebrating its 40th year on the air with these New Rochelle radio stations, WVOX 1460 AM and WVIP 93.5 FM. We can say with great pride, says station owner William O'Shaughnessy, that these are the only broadcasts of their kind in the New York metropolitan region. Temple Israel reaches over the airwaves to bring its worship services not only to the homebound, but also to non-Jewish people who want to better understand the Jewish faith.
Kol Nidre services can be heard on Friday evening, September 17th, from 5 to 6 p.m., and on Yom Kippur morning, Saturday, September 18th, the service will air live from 10 a.m. to noon, and the afternoon Askara memorial service and Ne'ila concluding service will be broadcast live from 2:30 to 6, so all can hear the final sounds of the shofar. Temple Israel is located at 1000 Pinebrook Boulevard. For more information, call 914-235-1800, and don't forget to tell your friends and neighbors to tune in. Thank you.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Forecast Westchester County in the vicinity for this afternoon. Plenty of sunshine once again. Slightly cooler. Highs will climb into the lower 70s under a northwesterly breeze. Mostly clear tonight. Overnight lows dropping close to 50. Partly sunny. Chance of a shower on Thursday. Highs into the lower 70s. Mostly sunny. Lower 70s on Friday. Saturday and Sunday each day we'll see plenty of sunshine. Highs will climb into the low to middle 70s. I'm Steve Pelletieri Jr. reporting for WVOX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates. I'm talking to Professor Richard Brightman, who has co-authored a revealing new look at FDR's role regarding strict immigration quotas before World War II. Before the break, I asked the following question of Professor Brightman. Why did FDR change his views about refugees and refugee policy over time? And why was there so much congressional opposition to European immigration?
FDR was president for a long time. The world changed and the United States changed during that period. And he was a pragmatic politician. He had to adapt to some of the constraints that existed politically, socially, and economically. So he did shift quite a bit over time, and that's been one of the more revealing aspects of doing this kind of research, is to to trace the shifts and try to explain them according to circumstances. As far as Congress is concerned, Congress had heavily passed the immigration restriction of the 1920s. Congress was also influenced by the Depression. Foreigners coming into the country didn't have much of a support in Congress, and Jews probably less than other kinds of foreigners.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. We have a caller. Caller, say hello and give a question to Professor Brightman.
Oh, hi, Mr. Garfunkel. This is Joe. Great program, as always. I apologize for my ignorance of Mr. McDonald, so I'm just going to have to go and buy your book and read up on him. I have a couple questions, one about the isolationist tone at the time, and the second about the actual refugees. First question, do you feel that, in addition to the horrors of World War One, that Americans looked at Europe and saw the harsh reparations that like the French and the invasion of the World Valley, you know, they did on the Germans, and I know the Americans pulled out of reparations pretty quickly, and they said, like, well, that's your problem, you know, you handle it. And do you think maybe that there was an element of that in isolation? And the second about the refugees, the Kinder transport taking children from Germany to England, I think it was at 39. Did that get any publicity in the U.S.? And if so, why wasn't that, attempt made to follow that policy here?
Thanks. Professor Brightman?
Sure. Very good questions. Isolationism, there was a tendency for Americans to say Europe made a mess of things. They got into war. They drew us into the war. And we fought for so long. And, there are still problems. Let's not get drawn in again. That wasn't the attitude of all of the politicians, but it was the attitude of a significant segment of the public, and politicians responded to that. Mm. Roosevelt was an internationalist and preferred to play an active American role, but in his first term, he was very sensitive, even during the election campaign, as well as in his first term. He was very sensitive to the fact that the majority of the country seemed to be in a mood to stay out of Europe, and he did not want to get too actively involved then. Mm-hmm. As the other Richard said, his quarantine speech in 1937 kind of marked a big step towards greater engagement, and that speech was heavily criticized, and so he had to bide his time.
Right, back off. You know, the country experienced large immigration waves in 1848 from famine in Ireland and revolution-torn Europe, and again in the period from 1880 to 1914 from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. After World War I, the newly Republican Congress passed very strict immigration laws with quotas reflective of American national origin, which we mentioned. The State Department was dominated by careerists and others who were isolationists. With that in mind, who was Breckinridge wrong, and what were his actions, and was he the problem?
Okay, I will deal with that, but let me give our questioner the answer on the Kinder transport
first. Oh, sure, go ahead,
first.
Sure.
The Americans did not agree to any kind of special measure for children the way the British did. But in the period when the British were taking in German Jewish children, the American quota for Germany, which was by then Germany and Austria, so it was more than 27,000, was actually filled. That was one of the decisions that Roosevelt made in the aftermath of the Anschluss in 1938, that the full quota was now going to be used and those tight regulations were going to be loosened. Okay, on to Breckinridge Long. Breckinridge Long was a conservative Democratic politician who linked up with FDR and earned a certain amount of credit for doing that. He became ambassador to Italy, where he kind of liked Mussolini's way of doing things, came back to the country, and eventually he got appointed as Assistant Secretary of State for Special War Problems, and that included the Visa Division. So he oversaw the administration of the visa system and immigration. And that was a key position. Now, was he the problem? Well, the mood of the country changed in 1940. Part of the prevailing wisdom was that Germany had been able to conquer other countries because of espionage and sabotage and propaganda, right, that there was a fifth column weakening the democracies. And a lot of people, not just Breckinridge Long, believed that it was necessary to be very careful with anything to do with foreigners, and that meant those immigration regulations which had been loosened in 1938 or different regulations got tightened in 1940, and I think Roosevelt himself went along with this. I don't think it was just Breckinridge Long, and I don't think Breckinridge Long was the only one in the State Department who were fanatically concerned about security.
Right. You know, we're going to get into this. We're going to. We only have a short period of time before our next break, but I know the issue of kinder transport's important, and of course, this reacts to the Wagner-Rogers bill. And I think after the break, you'll be able to comment on this, which was, of course, to bring in 20 to 25,000 German children who were obviously mostly Jewish. FDR initialed no action on the bill, and this was very troubling to historians, and basically it was because he understood there was no support in Congress for Jewish children. What was no action a rejection or reality?
I think it was a reality. By the time he wrote no action, it was clear in Congress that it wasn't going to go anywhere. Senator Wagner, who was one of the co-sponsors, was already unhappy about the crippling amendments that had been attached to the bill.
We have to go to a break. When we come back, we'll get into talking about people like Henry Morgenthau, Samuel Rosenman, who are Jews and advisors to FDR with regards to what their opinions were to the persecution of Jews. I just want to remind our audience that they're listening to WVOX 1460, live streaming on WVOX.com with my guest, Professor Richard Brightman, and we're talking about immigration, quotas, and escaping the death camps of the Nazis. We'll be back in a moment or so. Thank you.
From morning.
Wakes me up every morning and keeps me going all day.
Till night.
I listen all day.
You can count on us, WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. We could be coming to the end of a major phase in the worst oil spill in the nation's history.
We're within a 96-hour window of killing the well.
National Incident Commander Thad Allen saying the blown-out well in the Gulf is to be sealed on Sunday as a relief well is expected to intersect with it, mud and cement then pumped in. Allen also saying,
this is my third day in the Gulf and I've ate seafood every day I've been here. This seafood is ready for the rest of the world and the rest of the world needs to know that.
The White House weighing in on some primary election results.
The Republicans in Delaware nominated somebody that they don't believe can win. I think in the words of the state party chair, couldn't be elected dog catcher.
Spokesperson Robert Gibbs on the Republican Party upset by Tea Party favorite Christine O'Donnell. The GOP saying change is coming in November. And in the Times Square bombing attempt, a New York man has been charged with unwittingly providing unlicensed banking services to the main suspect in the plot. Fox News. We report, you decide.
Today's public service programs are brought to you by the Burnback Law Firm of White Plains. This famous Manhattan law firm, now in Westchester, is a national leader in workplace job discrimination issues. Headed by attorney Jeffrey M. Burnback, the author of the well-known book, Job Discrimination, How to Fight, How to Win, the classic text informing employees of legal options available in cases of job discrimination, the Burnback Law Firm is located in downtown White Plains at 245 Main Street across from City Center. Airline founder Don Burr says Jeff Burnback's overview and knowledge of job discrimination ranks with other sweeping visions of employee empowerment. Another reviewer said, as a lawyer and public servant, Jeff Burnback has been drawn relentlessly, almost irresistibly, to the side of those who faced discrimination in all its forms. His entire life and law practice are dedicated to those who find themselves without an advocate when the roof caves in at work. Now, all this great knowledge, dedication, and expertise is available in our area at the Burnback Law Firm in White Plains, 914-428 428-9100. Area code 914-428-9100.
There are quite a number of neighborhood flower shops around Westchester County these days. As in all things, some are better than others. And in the Colonial Village Shopping Center on Weaver Street in Scarsdale, just to the north of New Rochelle, there exists a florist of very great style and renown. Colonial Village Flowers specializes in beautiful seasonal flowers arranged in good taste with the lovely low-key result that all Colonial Village presentations, bouquets, and arrangements look like they were actually grown, collected, and gathered in the natural setting of your own garden. Good taste in flowers has for years been a special trademark of Joe Ward and his talented floral arrangers at Colonial Village, featuring the natural look without pomp or ceremony. So please know that there is at least one flower shop on your classy wavelength. Joe Ward's Colonial Village Flowers at 1515 Weaver Street in Scarsdale. Call 723-2888. That's 723-2 3/8.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of Judge Sandy Scherr, Karen and Jeff Birnbach, Janet and Ken Rasky, head of the Greater New York Hospital Association, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with Professor Richard Brightman. We're talking about immigration in the 1930s, FDR's administration's response to it. You know, many revisionist critics of FDR accuse him of ignoring the threat to the Jews in Germany, then Austria, then the Sudetenland in the years before World War II. They also accuse him of not working hard enough to revise our immigration laws, liberalize the quotas, the very restrictive quotas of national origin, and convincing the British to open up Palestine to Jewish refugees. In your book, Refugees and Rescue, how do you what is the difference that you show, and is there a change to this perception, Professor Brightman?
Well, first of all, there was a period where Roosevelt was working fairly hard. He raised the idea of raising the immigration level either by an act of Congress or somehow getting around Congress, and his cabinet rejected it. He did put some pressure on the British to open up Jewish immigration to Palestine. That's a subject that still needs some more research. But as I indicated before the break, he also changed over time. So once you get into the war, security problems and other priorities, such as trying to convince the American public that Britain being conquered would not be a good thing for American interests, Roosevelt's priorities shifted. His difficulties with Congress increased, not decreased, and his efforts, his humanitarian side, certainly lessened over time.
And you know, you do mention in your book, and it's been mentioned in other places, that many of the unfortunate Jews that were, they were seen fortunate to be released from Germany, had families back in Germany, and they, a number of them, not a significant number, but certain of them were abused. They were threatened over the lives of their families, and they turned into fifth columns themselves, but this was a small number. What effect was that on a chilling effect on American idea of bringing Jews into the country?
Well, there was a new regulation that the State Department put through called the Close Relatives Clause. Anyone who had close relatives was considered to be a close relative staying in Germany, automatically considered to be a security threat. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine how that stopped up granting of visas. And the actual number of Jews engaged in espionage, willing or unwilling, on behalf of Germany was minuscule, right. But the fear was so great that it applied to large numbers.
No question. And it's interesting in reflection on that. Could you draw a conclusion that the anti-Semitism in Germany was being spread like a virus to Germans all over Europe and America. You know, there was very little anti-Semitism in the United States before the 1930s. Some came because of the Depression, but also we were 40% German blood in the United States. Do you think this on-the-surface success in Germany spread to Germans, German-Americans here?
Well, there were some pro-Nazi German-American organizations, the Bund, for example, partly acting independently, but partly under the influence of Nazi officials and Nazi financing. And in fact, Nazi Germany tried to work against the re-election of Franklin Roosevelt a couple of times. So, you could say they were trying to spread their ideology and their anti-Semitism. I think there was some native anti-Semitism as well, but Nazi Germany certainly thought that it could increase the level of anti-Semitism through its activities.
Yeah, it's interesting. They did influence a number of labor union leaders, conservative unions, the coal miners' union head. It slips my mind the moment I feel embarrassed, but he was actually secretly paid to come out against Roosevelt in 1940.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting, the pervasiveness of their network. You know, FDR knew that intervention to save Britain was out of the question. The public and the Congress were dynamically and diametrically opposed to declaring war on Germany and expanding immigration quotas. But war aid through Lend-Lease was critical. Was the passage of Lend-Lease, to a degree, the immigration trade-off?
I see Lend-Lease as part of a pattern. From 1939 on, Roosevelt was trying to get Congress to loosen foreign policy restrictions so that he could do what he needed to do in America's interest.
Because there was
it was the neutrality laws that were the problem.
Right.
And then it was the fact that Britain was in danger of being conquered and needed military equipment, and so Lend-Lease came around. But really, during that whole period from the start of World War II in the fall of 1939 until the United States actually entered the war, not by choice, but by Japanese Act and German Act, then Roosevelt was struggling to free himself from congressional restrictions and a slightly negative public opinion that didn't want Germany to win but didn't want the United States to get involved in the war.
You know, it's interesting, just to make sure our audience understands this, the Southern delegations in Congress in both houses, I believe, added up to 224 representatives in the House and the Senate. I believe that in polling these Southern delegations, that the vote was 0-224 for immigration on any test votes, and for Lend-Lease, it was 224-0 for Lend-Lease. And we know how critical Lend-Lease was. We know Churchill's remarks about Lend-Lease. So it's interesting to me that Roosevelt understood that he had to be pragmatic about what the people felt in this country. And, of course, he bent over backwards to change attitudes. But I think this is very critical. You know, FDR is the most written about individual in history. There are book treatments regarding his life, the Great Depression, the New Deal, his family, his relationships, the two world wars, his struggle with polio, and sources of other aspects. How is it possible, Professor Brightman, to learn more about a president that's already been studied so intensively?
Well, McDonald's diary is one example of material that was in private hands. Very few people knew about it. It was separated. The family had part of the diary, and part of it McDonald had given to somebody else. And when the pieces of the diary came together at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, then it was possible to see that you could get good insight into a broad period of history from looking at this diary. This is, however, one example of a broader tendency. Roosevelt didn't keep a diary. Mm-hmm. He didn't write a lot of long letters to friends and associates. He didn't even write very many long memoranda. So he liked to talk to people. And unless you follow whom he met with day by day and then do a diligent search for their papers and their correspondence and so forth, you don't necessarily get insight into how he maneuvered from day to day and from year to year. And I do think that there will be more material on Franklin Roosevelt and the Jews in the future.
Thank you. We have one call. We're running down in time. Quick point, caller.
Yes, it's Mr. Cam from New Rochelle. I don't know if I heard you right, but did you say that there wasn't much anti-Semitism in the 30s in the U.S.?
No, prior to that. I wanted to declare that anti-Semitism, and clarify that, was really came out in its form that we understand today out of the Depression in the 1930s. That's my point.
Came out of the Depression.
Well, there's always been insipid anti-Semitism.
Okay, well, I would say it was rampant in the 30s.
No, it was.
We had Father Coughlin. We had anti-Semitic people in the House Un-American Activities Committee. A few years later, the church, there was some residual anti-Semitism in the Catholic Church. Small town America was very anti-Semitic. The Klan was also anti-Semitic. Mm. So it was rampant in the United States, and there's still a little bit of it around, and I don't think we should kind of exculpate the American people from this.
I thank you very much. I think you make a very good point there. I think you're correct. We're running down on time. I want to thank Professor Brightman for joining the Advocates today. I want to recommend his book, Refugees and Rescue. And before they end, anything new coming on your horizon, Professor Brightman?
Well, I'm working on a book on Roosevelt now.
Excellent. Thank you. I'll add another one to the 400 I have. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where information, my guests, will be posted. Next week, I'll be discussing with Joshua Friedman his book, Inside Change, and how one transforms one's organizational with emotional intelligence. I want to wish everybody who celebrates a happy new year, and especially Professor Brightman, and to all who celebrate, of course. Thank you, and let's have a great week and great year ahead of us. Thank you, Professor Brightman, again.